the 9th chapter. As Jesus went out from there, two blind men following him, crying loudly, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." When he entered the house, the blind men came to him, and Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" They said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith, let it be done to you." And their eyes were opened. Then Jesus sternly ordered them, "See that no one knows of this." But they went away and spread the news about him throughout that district. After they had gone away, a demoniac who was mute was brought to Jesus. And when the demon had been cast out, the one who had been mute spoke. And the crowds were amazed and said, "Never has anything like this been seen in Israel." But the Pharisees said, "By the ruler of the demons, he casts out the demons." The Gospel of the Lord. Three points. The first, God is no longer inevitable. The second, we have appointed ourselves judges over our own works. And third, faith in Jesus gives us something to say. With those three points, three musical references. God is no longer inevitable. There were five seminarians from Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, the premier Lutheran seminary where I graduated from, as compared to Gettysburg, where my colleagues have attended, who were on a couple-day trip to West Virginia to do some hiking, to do some camping, to do some horseback riding, and to do some whitewater rafting. One of the seminarians, on occasion as we were driving down I-77, would just start humming the banjo theme from the movie Deliverance as a reminder of where we were heading. First day was a beautiful day. We spent time hiking out in the mountains of West Virginia, had a good quiet night. The next day we went horseback riding for 8 hours, and that night we were all laying by the campfire. Notice I said laying by the campfire because it hurt too much to sit after riding horses for 8 hours. We looked at this beautiful fire and someone said, "What is it about a campfire?" Now, had there been scientists in our midst, we might have responded, "Well, what is it about a campfire? It's a chemical reaction between oxygen in the atmosphere and wood that's ignited by a match that eventually heats the wood up to 300 degrees. When the wood hits 300 degrees Fahrenheit, some of the wood decomposes due to the heat, and this decomposed material is released as gas, which we call smoke. The rest of the wood is either pure carbon or pure ash. The side effect of this action is called heat. The rising carbon atoms emit light, which we call flame. The color variation is due to uneven temperature in the flame. And finally, the flames the way they burn is determined by the force of gravity. We are, however, theologians, not scientists. Instead, we, as we reflected upon that moment in the glory of God's kingdom, were able to see the living presence of God in the beauty of creation. Similar to what the psalmist writes in Psalm 19, the heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament declares God's handiwork. Paul picks it up in Romans. Ever since the creation of the world, God's eternal power and divine nature is invisible, yet having been understood and seen through the things that God has made. That for us, it was inevitable that we would see God in the midst of creation. A German folk song captures that same essence. In part, it goes, "The moon has climbed into the sky where golden stars shine bright and clear. The woods are dark and silent, and from the meadows, like a dream, the white fog rises in the air." This German folk song goes on to become more of a prayer, asking God to provide for poor and prideful sinners so that they may see salvation when they die. And on earth, the singer asks God to help him or her to be like little children, cheerful and faithful. We live in a time, however, when it is not inevitable that people will find the living presence of God in what they see and in what they hear. They will draw many other conclusions. God is not inevitable. And as a result, we appoint ourselves judges over our own works. In this poem by Stephen Crane, a man said to the universe, "Sir, I exist." "However," replied the universe, "the fact does not create in me a sense of obligation." The universe, as Eric Wilson writes, is not friendly. And the universe is not sensitive to our needs. So what is it that we hold on to help us get through what we face each and every day being part of this universe? We have become people of technique. We look for the right technique to help us get through. So we can find the right technique to help us with our anxieties. We can find the right technique to help us with our anger. We can find the right technique to help us with our marriages. We can find the right technique to make sure our sex life is better. It is boiled down to technique. But perhaps it's not in our best interest to find a technique that takes away all of the anxiety. Perhaps in that moment of dread and brooding and worry and frustration that our creativity is born. Look at the works of Emily Dickinson. Look at the works of some major artists throughout time. It was in the moments of their deepest despair that their most beautiful work came to expression. with technique, then we alone become the judge of our works. What works and what doesn't. So we have replaced spiritual devotion with technique. And thus the second musical reference, this time from the contemporary group called Killers. The song, Are We Human or Are We Dancers? They sing, pay my respects to grace and virtue. Send my condolences to good. Give my regards to soul and romance. They always did the best that they could. And so long to devotion. You taught me everything I know. Wave goodbye, wish me well. You've got to go. Are we human or are we dancers? My sign is vital, my hands are cold, and I'm on my knees looking for an answer. Are we human or are we dancers? God is no longer inevitable, and we become the judges of our own works. When it comes to the judgment of others, we do have the mental capacity, and we have the vocabulary, we have the words and the speech to come to our defense against those who would judge us. However, there is one who will judge us, to whom we have no defense, and in front of whom we become mute. Elie Wiesel, in his book Twilight, writes a story about a university professor who is working with a psychiatric patient. The psychiatric patient is convinced that he is dead, and he describes to his psychiatrist what it means to be in the coffin. He says what he finds when he believes that he's in the coffin is this true feeling that he is there and he is alone. And he is remembering what he had been taught since childhood, that when you are in your grave and waiting for the angel of death to appear, you must rehearse who you are. So as he's laying in his grave, he's rehearsing that my name is Moshe, son of Yitzhak, because the angel of death, it is taught, will teach, ask you who you are. If you can name who you are, you will be brought into redemption. He rehearses that until he hears a scratching on the top of his casket. And he realizes at that terrifying moment that it's the angel of death who has come. And at that moment, he's horrified because he is so frightened he can't talk. And all of that rehearsal to lift up who he is, he was mute before that moment. And then the greater horror when he discovered that the angel of death had no ears. It was all eyes, searching him through to the depth of his soul. The judgment of God is a judgment that searches each one of us through to the depth of our souls. Those thoughts that go through our minds that we will never, ever say out loud to anyone. those glances that we take at things that we are embarrassed to tell people that we are looking at. Those beliefs in the depth of our hearts that we know people would revile us for if they knew we believed them. God searches out to the depth of our souls who we are. And so it is important, brothers and sisters, that we know our judge. And we know our judge because God revealed who he was through Jesus Christ. And at the moment when we are mute and can have nothing to speak on our behalf, Jesus pleads with God for our salvation. Because his death on the cross is a death that saves everyone. Now, my parents are here, and I would give my life for them. As we are gathered here today, I would do everything I could for your well-being. But there are just some in the world that I would be hard-pressed to sacrifice my life for. Jesus gives his life for everybody. And it is through his death that we are saved. Our faith, then, in Jesus is what gives us a voice. It is not a voice that we are to use to justify ourselves before God, but our faith gives us a voice to speak on behalf of those who can no longer plead on their own behalf, because the world has become so heavy upon them that they have nothing more to say. It was Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in the midst of Hitler's rise to power in Germany, that gives us this last musical statement, because he believed that his faith called him to speak on behalf of the Jew. And he said this: "Only he who cries out for the Jews may sing Gregorian chant." That to dare to sing to God when others are mute under the weight of oppression means to speak out against the suffering of others. To claim to be part of the church, we will speak out and confess our faith in the face of anything that brings oppression and suffering to others. So that is why when we gather here next week, I've changed the topic of the sermon, to be titled, "The Christian Speaks to the Madman." What a Christian can say to Muammar Gaddafi and what's happening in Libya. For we as Christians have the voice of faith that calls us to speak out on behalf of those who are mute. Amen.